Ghost Knight Media Studios and Paranormal Underground Magazine, welcome to Paranormal Underground Radio. It's time to explore the unexplained with your hosts, Rick Hale and Karen Frazier.
Now.
Are we on now?
Are we supposed to talk?
That means go live means we're on the air.
Okay, hey everybody.
Hey, it is Thursday. We're real pros.
No, it's not our fault. It's the system. It's not jiving.
Hey everybody, welcome to Paranormal Underground Radio.
Yes, we're having another one of our destination truth moments. We seem to have a lot of them. I think it's sunspots.
I think that's right. So,
all right, well,
we can't hear our audio tonight, folks. So,
yeah,
buckle up, and we'll see how we do.
Yeah. Now I got an LOL in the chat room from Chris Valley Ghost Hunting, so I'm assuming they can hear us in there. Is that right, Chris? Can you hear us? Let's see.
It's there, Rick. When
yes,
you ask
there
that,
we go.
There's like a big, huge delay.
Okay.
So you know, they'll 20 seconds after you ask that question, somebody will say, yes, we can hear you.
Okay. All right. I'm new to this. I mean, even though we've been doing this almost
a year. There you go. Somebody just said, yes, we can hear you about 20 seconds after you ask.
Okay. All right. Well, then we're just going to go right into it. We have got an excellent show lined up for you guys. First, we're going to be talking to Kim Casey. She is the author of a work of fiction called Breaking the Beyond. And then after that, we're going to welcome back to the show Bill Murphy from Sci-Fi Channel's Fact or Faked, which is actually one of the shows that I really like. And we're going to be talking to him and his wife, Anita, about Thoughtform Manifestation Conference. So that should be really interesting, because thought forms are definitely something that I've always been very interested in. So, Karen, we've had a little bit of a shakeup in the paranormal world this week, and something that you wanted to talk about, and I think it's going to leave a lot of people, you know, crying their EMF detector. So what?
Hey, I wasn't the only one who wanted to talk about it. You said you brought it up first.
Yeah, I know. So
yeah. Grant Wilson leaving Ghost Hunters.
I know. But what's that all about? I wonder what happened.
I think probably, I think that putting your life on display like that for as long as they have, they've been on for several years now. And I think when you put your life on display in that manner, I think it grows. I think that some people thrive on it. And I think for other people, it's very difficult. So it's probably a personal decision, a family decision, something along those lines. And, you know, I have to tell you, he's always been my very favorite person when I do watch the show. And mm-hmm. So I'm sorry to see him go.
No, I am too. You know, I've never made it any great secret. I'm not a fan of the show. However, I will watch depending on where it is that they investigate. But Grant was the softer side of the lead investigators. He seemed to be the more diplomatic, the nicer guy, you know, whereas Jason was very gruff. It was sort of like a good ghost hunter, bad ghost hunter kind of a thing. But good cop, bad cop.
You know, and I never bought into the whole Jason Haas is this kind of gruff, jerky guy, because his personality actually reminds me a lot of Techie McScience Geek. So I'm, mm-hmm. you know, I'm married to that kind of alpha male personality. And so I always see people talking about Jason and how, you know, he's so bossy and blah, blah, blah. You know what? He reminds me of my husband. So including the no hair part.
Yeah. You know, I'm sure they're great guys. And the thing about Ghost Hunters, like I said, I'm not a fan, but they have done some outstanding work in the field.
They have.
They really have. I mean, they've made it more open and accessible to people. However, at the same time, just grabbing an EMF detector and a digital voice recorder does not a psychical researcher make. There's a lot more that goes into this than just, you know, running into an abandoned building and screaming at something that may or may not even be there.
I agree with you. Yeah. So. Definitely. So because we got started late, I think we need to, I know our guest is waiting for us to call her. So mm-hmm. even though you guys just got us, we probably do need to go to break so that we can get our guest kept on, and we'll be right back. Paranormal Underground Radio on Z-Talk Radio.
Stick around.
Business owner, you are paying too much for products and services. Do not spend your hard-earned cash on items you can get on trade. UTXTrade.com was formed specifically so you can trade your products or services with other companies on the network for items like advertising, computer repair, office furniture, printing, hotel stays, and much more. For more information, please visit UTXTrade.com. That's UTXTrade.com. A proud sponsor of ParanormalLeagueOfAmerica.org.
This is John Mayer for RAD, recording artists, actors, and athletes against drunk driving. On stage, it's fun to push the limits and see where it takes me. Off stage, it's a different story. Get behind the wheel of a car after you've been drinking and you risk causing a crash, hurting, or even killing someone. When you're enjoying a few drinks, know your limit and don't push it. Plan ahead and give up the keys. You'll make it a safer weekend for everyone.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
In her riveting novel, Breaking the Beyond, writer Kim Casey brings to life a supernatural tale filled with mystery, humor, and intrigue. Kim's suspenseful story focuses on Risa, a compassionate social worker who assists Owen, a young psychiatric patient. Is a 300-year-old entity speaking through Owen, or does he simply possess multiple personalities? Visit awningpublishing.ca to order your copy of Breaking the Beyond. That's A-H-N-E-E-N. Publishing.ca.
Hi, I'm Chad Wilson, publisher and co-founder of Paranormal Underground Magazine.
And I'm Cheryl Knight, editor-in-chief and co-founder of Paranormal Underground Magazine.
Every month, Paranormal Underground explores the unexplained with a free monthly online magazine.
We take an in-depth look at all kinds of unexplained phenomena, talk with some of the field's top experts, and share the latest news and information about the paranormal.
Visit us at ParanormalUnderground.net, where you can read the magazine online, explore our paranormal evidence galleries, watch videos, participate in discussions, or read blogs with some of our writers and editors.
We hope you'll join us. Visit ParanormalUnderground.net and explore the unexplained.
Do you want to keep up with what's going on at Paranormal Underground?
Then tweet us on Twitter at ParanormalUG.
Or follow us on Facebook at Paranormal Underground.
Meet us on MySpace, Paranormal Underground.
There's no need to be in the dark about what's going on at Paranormal Underground. Join us on your favorite social networking site today.
Station identification.
You're listening to ZTalk Radio Network.
Operating frequency
on ztalkradio.com. Radio, its affiliates, or sponsors.
Okay, welcome back, everybody, to Paranormal Underground Radio at ztalkradio.com. I am your host, Rick Hale. Unfortunately, Karen has had to go because she's having some really serious computer problems. So you'll be dealing with just me tonight. So lucky you. For the first hour, I wanted to welcome our guest. Her name is Kim Casey, and she is an author. She has written a work of fiction called Breaking the Beyond, which talks quite a bit about mental illness and the possibility of it being things being paranormally related. So, Kim, welcome to the underground.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You know, I'm gonna admit to you, I have not read your book, but however, what I have seen of it sounds very interesting. One of the things that's always interested me about the paranormal, and especially people who have, suffer from mental illness. I myself work in the mental health field, and I oftentimes wonder, and I know a lot of other psychical researchers wonder as well, that if there maybe is something that, people are actually becoming sensitive to, psychic manifestations, and that appears to be what your book is talking about. Can you give us a really good sketch of what your of what it's about?
Well, my book, actually, it's about a social worker who's working in a hospital setting, and she's working with a client that initially comes in because of suicidal issues and alcoholism and things like that. As she's working with him, there's more than one personality presenting to her through this individual. Okay. And what she comes to try to struggle with is whether there's more than one personality or whether one of the personalities claims to be a being that's part of a cult called the Deathwalkers. And she's trying to figure out whether this is just, two personalities emanating from one individual or whether this really could be a Deathwalker. And as the story unfolds, you start to learn what it really is.
Right.
And the other plots in the book evolve around her. It's sort of like there's three subplots and they all intertwine. The other plot is the main character is Risa, the social worker, and she's a single parent, and she's raising a daughter on her own. And as the story unfolds, the daughter is confronted with some very dangerous situations that that Risa, the mother, must confront. And the other issue that she deals with is her job as a social worker and the things that go on there. And at the conclusion of the book, they all intertwine and come to a really good conclusion.
Okay.
In relation to your question, though, about I used to be a social worker, and I worked in the mental health field for a long time, and I came across a book, and this is actually the inspiration for this story, was one of the inspirations, about there's a psychologist, a legitimate psychologist working out of the United States, who talks about that there are people, apparently, that are inhabited by dead people.
Yeah.
She believes that she works with them, and she believes that there are people that have died that don't want to pass on, and that they're stuck on this realm, or they choose to stay stuck, and what they do is they inhabit people's bodies, and they sort of wreak havoc with them. And unfortunately, the people that they're using as their host don't know it.
Right. Yeah, definitely. And I've come across what I would call spirit oppression. I've never actually come across an actual possession. But do you think that there could be, an inhuman entity? I really don't believe in demons per se. But do you think that some kind of inhuman entity could enter somebody and masquerade as a human?
Absolutely.
Spirit. Absolutely.
Oh, you mean like something that's never been human?
Yes, something that's never been human.
Oh, I'm not sure about that. I'm okay. more clear about, you know, human beings that have died and passed on, or not passed on.
Right.
You know, there's people that specialize in demonology and things like
sure.
that, and they deal with all these, and I find that quite fascinating.
Now,
I haven't come across it myself either.
Yeah. Have you yourself dealt with anybody when you were a social worker that you would say that, you know what, there might be some kind of separate personality, an external personality here?
Well, you know, I've dealt with people that actually have multiple personality.
Okay.
And usually they come from walks of life where they've been severely traumatized.
Sure.
And it's a legitimate psychiatric label. It's legitimate. It's real. They call it dissociative identity disorder now, I believe.
Right.
And yes, I have dealt with people like that. And it's kind of tricky and hard because they usually, each personality has its own separate identity, and when one's kicking in, the others aren't.
Yeah.
So when you're dealing with one personality, the other ones are sort of like on a vacation. So then when another one kicks in, if it chooses to deal with you, it may not know what the other one told you. And the poor person goes through these periods of blackouts and amnesia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'll have like a full life. Like one woman, young woman I met, she was a survivor of sexual abuse, and her coping strategy became developing personalities. And she said, you know, I ended up in one of my personalities calling the detective and talking very candidly about the abuse and wanting to press charges, and completely forgot about it because it was one personality. And then a few days later, she found his card and couldn't figure out what was the detective doing in her home, followed it up and found out what she had done.
Yeah.
So that's where it gets tricky because...
Now, these spirits that could, you know, be inside people... would you say that they definitely, you know, work not so much against the person, but try to work with the person to work out their initial problem?
I would think they're more destructive than anything. Even this book, this woman, her name is Edith Fiore, I believe, F-I-O-R-E. She's mm-hmm. a legitimate psychologist. So she talks about that, and she says that their intent is just pure selfishness. When they inhabit a person's body, it's because often they have addictions that they had when they owned a body, like smoking or drinking or whatever, and they want to continue on. So they inhabit a person's body just to have their own fun.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, proceed.
No, proceed, please.
Well, I was just going to say is that... It would really appear. I mean, as I've been, you know, investigating the paranormal or psychical research now for about 20 years, and I would say that for the most part, the kind of spirits that I deal with are really benign and they don't mean anybody any harm. Now, do you think that there is a greater strength of will to one of these human spirits that, you know, they're a little bit more selfish?
I'm not sure. I'm wondering, too, if this is a side question, but with all the work that you've done, have you ever had experiences where spirits tried to harm you or follow you home or do things to you?
I've never had anything follow me home. However, the very first investigation I ever did, I was maybe 17 or 18 years old, had no idea what I was doing, but I was asked to come to this house where a young girl claimed that she was coming out of a cult situation, and the leader of the cult had placed a curse on her, and she was claiming to see like these large shadowy beings. Well, I went to the house. I was interested to find out what was going on. I had already been interested in psychical research and for about 10 years, since I was about 8 years old. And when I got there, it was, you know, I'm like, all right, there's really nothing going on here. But as the night progressed, I sat in one room and the girl sat in the other room. She was trying to sleep, and all of a sudden I hear her say, "Rick, they're here." So I walk into the room, and right away I could feel that the air was charged with some kind of energy. You know, you can kind of like feel that where your hair stands on end. You can feel it prickling on your skin.
Yeah.
And I start addressing, you know, whatever it is that this girl's seeing. All of a sudden, this humongous black shadow just appears right in front of me and pushes me. And I mean, it gave me a hard enough push that I landed right on my butt. And that was For me, when I think of something like that, it's like, wow, that's kind of scary. Some people would think that's scary, but for me, that's like, that's cool. Because this is kind of like, you know, it's validation for, you know, the things that I have believed in, you know, since I was a child. But that was the first and not the last time that I've been attacked by a spirit entity. The second time was at an investigation about a year and a half ago in Waukegan, Illinois. I'm in Chicago, by the way. And I was addressing this spirit, and all of a sudden my head started to hurt so bad. And a horrible headache, and I had one of our mediums, she said that something has just attacked you. And I looked in the mirror, and sure enough, I've got this big red spot across my forehead. It looks like a hand had literally just smacked me. Now, I never felt the smack, but I felt the after effects of the smack.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's been a few other times where, you know, I feel that, you know, something has tried to, you know, come after me. But, you know, I've never had anything follow me home. And I've been really fortunate for that.
As far as not following you home, but I mean, so there's been no after effect? Like when you left these investigations, nothing came with you? You didn't have even dreams or anything? It's just...
No, I've always personally believed that if a person's will is strong enough, that something isn't going to try to oppress or possess you. I know that in demonology, now I'm not a demonologist by any means, but I have studied it a little bit. I know that a demonologist will say that a spirit, either human or inhuman, will enter you through some kind of a weakness. You know, you might have a weakness of your will or, you know, through some kind of an addiction. I don't have any addictions, and I'm actually very much a confident person. So, and I've always been like that ever since I was a kid. So I definitely think that that has something to do with it. Your kind of, your personality has a lot to do with keeping things away and out.
What about spiritual beliefs? Where are they for you? I mean, that's a personal question, but...
Oh, no, that's quite all right. I actually very much believe in Eastern religions. I like to consider myself a Buddhist. However, I'm not really, you know, living a Buddhist lifestyle, I guess you could say. But I definitely believe in not really, you know, Westernized religions, definitely more Eastern. I like the kind of peace of mind that Zen meditation gives me. And usually before an investigation, I'm also really into working out. I'll do a really extra long workout, and then I'll do a meditation where I imagine the light of, you know, Buddha coming around me. And, you know, I really do feel that that is what protects me from, you know, anything that it may come up against.
Wow. In the Buddhist tradition, though, I mean, do they even acknowledge the other side?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, you get the idea of people leaving this world and, you know, getting... We're always caught in the wheel of samsara, you know, the wheel of birth, death, and rebirth. However, I have read something that in the Mahayana tradition that there is another part of that, and it's sort of an intermediate stage where an attachment will keep a person tied to this world until they are able to get rid of that attachment. And that's what Buddhism is pretty much about for me and a lot of people, is shedding these attachments so you can, you know, get off the wheel of misfortune, I guess you could say, of samsara, and eventually end up in, you know, some kind of afterlife.
A more enlightened state of mind.
Exactly.
A physical body.
Exactly. So, that's what I do. Before I enter into any kind of investigation.
Well, you know, you raise a good point there, because when I watch a lot of these shows, like I'm a real fan of some of these investigative shows and that, mm-hmm. and I notice that some of them really focus on the negative and, you know, the demons and the demonology and that, and they seem mm-hmm. to come from a more of a Christian base. And I often wonder if, you know, there's that old saying, you only see what you look for.
Yeah.
So if you believe in the demonology, or if you believe in those things, then that's the thing you're going to focus on, or that's how you'll interpret it.
Right. But I think when it comes to demons, you have to have a belief system that encompasses demons in order for there to be a demon. Since I don't really believe in the whole idea of fallen angels, you know, the angels that were naughty and God kicked out of the earth and they eventually became the demons, I don't really believe in that. So it's not in my belief system, therefore it doesn't exist.
Yeah, and I mean, that would be probably your biggest protection. I mean, how can something harm you if it does exist? I mean, you don't even acknowledge it.
Yeah. You know, with the thing that pushed me over in my very first investigation, I really do believe that that was what you would consider to be a thought form. And actually, thought forms or tulpas come up a lot in Tibetan Buddhism. That's what we're going to be talking with Bill and Anita Murphy next about, is thought form manifestations or thought form manifestation conference. And I do believe that this was something that was, I don't want to use the term magical, but definitely supernatural or preternatural in nature, that this was a curse that was put on this girl. And by the strength of will of the person putting the curse on her, this thing was able to attach itself and take form. And it was a big, humongous black shadow. So I definitely think that there's something to the idea of the tulpa in Tibetan Buddhism.
I had a confrontation with a cult here. That was the other inspiration of my book, actually. There's a cult called Ekankar. They present themselves in a different light, but when you shake it all down, they sort of take bits from Buddhism. They take bits from all kinds of different things. It's almost a very New Age thing.
Yeah.
And a couple of relatives of mine got involved in it back in the 80s. And the leader of the cult at the time, what had happened was when my relatives got involved in it, the rest of my family was quite alarmed by the whole process. And so I didn't want to judge, so I went to my aunt and uncle and tried to learn what they were learning and try to understand and met with the leader in that. And, you know, I really believe I was psychically attacked. You talk about the thought form and that's what sort of tricked it in there.
Well, how were you psychically attacked?
Well, it was really strange because I had met him and we had talked a few times and I was sort of getting these weird vibes from him, but I just thought it's because I'm uncomfortable with what he's talking about. And the whole premise of his religion is soul traveling, and they believe through soul travel that you can do what you do in Buddhism. You can sort of stop the reincarnation wheel, and that when you soul travel and you get more enlightened, that this will be your last lifetime. And well, they also believe that you can have walk-ins, that there are people that can actually walk into other people's bodies and take them over.
Yeah. Well, I know that... Oh, sorry.
No.
I was just going to say, I know that with Buddhism, I mean, of course, there being different schools of Buddhism. You got Mahayana, Zen, Theravada. Now, it is believed that the Buddha... The founder of this life philosophy, that he was able to have these sort of out of body experiences, and he was able to travel, and he was able, you know, in spiritual form, and the Buddha was able to go different places and see the kind of suffering there was in the world. And I personally believe that yes, he was able to do that, and that was probably the thing that really helped him teach his philosophy and, you know, and try to save the world.
Well, that makes sense. Well, the Ekankar people, this is the foundation of their teachings.
Mm-hmm.
So as a new initiate, you would be instructed by someone, you know, more knowledgeable, and they would teach you how to soul travel, how to get your soul out of your body and travel. And then at some point in your development, you get to go where the records are all kept of past lives.
Apparently the Akashic Records?
Yeah. Apparently they know how to get there, and so that's part of your training, is when you get to that point, you get to go look at your past records and see everything that you've done. And
I'm terrified to find
now.
Out.
Pardon?
I was just going to say, I'm actually terrified of the whole idea of looking at something like that. You know, like you take a look at your past lives. I have oftentimes thought about getting a past life regression, but in a way I'm kind of afraid because I don't want to find out that I was some kind of serial killer 100 years back. So it's possible. I mean, you know, hey, it could happen. So, but let's talk. Rick is Jack the Ripper. That's what somebody just wrote in our chat room right here. You know, I want to talk about these death walkers. Now, that is a really ominous term, death walker. What made you come up with such an ominous name for this cult?
Well, because it wasn't meant to be negative. As a death walker, initially death walkers were brought into being because they were they're human beings mm-hmm. who are taught how to soul travel. But the whole point of soul traveling is to help other people cross over. So as a death walker, if you get initiated into the society, it's a very sacred, special thing. And what happens is, once you're able to leave your body, you can help other people that are dying, that get lost and get stuck, and help them to cross over onto the other side.
Oh, so
what happens, though, is that some of the death walkers, because of the power and the things and the gifts that you get with that, some of them went power crazy with it and used it in ways they shouldn't have, which is part of the book.
Yeah, it sort of went over to the dark side of the Force, I guess you could say.
Yeah, well, I mean, isn't that really life? I mean, anytime someone gets into a leadership or a power position, mm-hmm. you know, the temptations are there.
Oh, I think that goes with any kind of, you know, I really hate using the term cult. I've always preferred alternative religious movement. But for the sake of brevity, of course, I'm going to use the term cult. With a cult, that always does kind of seem to be a major problem. You got like one guy who is, you know, people see him as being God. You know, we have the, I think his name was Applewhite with Heaven's Gate. And of course, there was David Koresh. It just seems that whenever you have people falling all over you and listening to every word you say, it's really not a stretch of the imagination to think that, yeah, your ego is going to get really huge. And you are capable, as a human, of doing some very, very nasty things to your fellow man.
I would think so. Yeah. No one's really going to stop you.
Yeah. Except it's the United States government, you know, coming into your compound and setting it on fire. But, you know.
Well, it's no different here in Canada.
Yeah. Now, with the character that is experiencing this this kind of spirit possession, what kind of stuff does he have happen in his life, you know, besides, of course, ending up in a mental institution that would lead him to believe? I mean, how has his personality changed? Or how does this thing...
The thing is, he doesn't ever know. The character, his name is Owen, that it's being used by an entity that has no clue. He never does. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what is it? Does this entity come out in therapy sessions?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Now,
with
does
the social worker?
Okay. Now, with the social worker, I know you said you yourself was in social work. Do you base Ryza off yourself and your own personal philosophy?
50-50, I would think. I'm a lot older. I mean, I'm almost 50. She's, you know, in her early 30s.
Okay.
Some of her, and I'm not a parent. I've never have been, so.
Okay.
Well, you know, her philosophy is just, you know, she's a caring soul who wants to help people. I mean, I hope that was what I conveyed when I worked in the profession.
Right.
But as far as the philosophy and that, mine, you know, I came from I was raised in a Christian background, mm-hmm. Catholic, Roman Catholic.
That's what I was raised in.
Yeah, and so that really impressed on me. I'm not a practicing Catholic now, but a lot of what I was taught, actually, I think that comes out in the book, because a lot of good and evil and things like that, that seems to be the mainstay of, in fact, like when I was growing up, The Exorcist came out when I was about 13, and my gosh, that was like, oh, it was a terrifying experience. One, I couldn't go to the theater. I wasn't old enough, but I remember our priest making a special visit to our classrooms to talk mm-hmm. about The Exorcist and possession and that how real it was mm-hmm. and how that the Pope had asked that people don't go see the movie.
Right.
Which is ironic.
Well, I think the movie kind of painted the Catholic Church in a negative light, because the Catholic Church is supposed to be the one that's like, man, we can get rid of this thing for you. And, well, they didn't. It just transferred from the little girl to this priest. So I think it definitely painted the, you know, the whole idea of exorcism in a negative light, that this stuff really doesn't work.
Well, And the other problem, though, was up until then, I didn't know this really happened. I mean, the devil was never really something one talked about. I mean, you mm-hmm. talked about evil and things like that in catechism, but the actual devil and his history and, you know, his supposed existence was never on the table for discussion. And suddenly at 13, I'm being told, oh, yes, there's a devil, and it can enter you at any time and, you know, wreak havoc with your life. It was a terrifying experience, and not being told how to deal with that. You know, like, these are the things you can do.
Well, I mean, just imagine it. You know, if you're a person in life and you like wreaking havoc in life, chances are your personality is not going to change when you die. And, you know, whether or not you go off to some kind of afterlife or you get unfortunately stuck here, you're definitely not going to change. The thing that hit me in the forehead was definitely the spirit of a man who he was a sexual predator in life. And he did it to his own children. And I think that I touched a chord with him because what I was talking about was, you know, how wrong and horrible that is. And I think that that's what, you know, caused him to give me a good smack. But we were actually able to get this guy to, you know, to move on to, you know, whatever afterlife, you know, may be a part of his belief system.
And he really left.
Yeah, they never had a problem with him again in the house. Our mediums had went in there, and I hate using it, this house is clean, you know, like that Poltergeist movie, but they were able to help this guy move on, and, you know, they were able to say that, you know, there's this guy is no longer here. So we were able to help this family, and at the same time we were able to help this spirit as well. I'm not really a soul rescuer. As an investigator, my idea is I am there not to prove or disprove anything. I am there merely to observe, document, and report. So that's, you know, that's with that. I mean, we're talking about, you mentioned the television shows a little bit earlier. I've never made it any great secret that I'm not really a fan of the television shows. For various different reasons, and one of those reasons is that, you know, you say that you go in there as a skeptic. Well, nobody is ever really a believer or a disbeliever. I don't believe, you know, no atheists in foxholes, as they say. But they go in there like, well, we're here to disprove that this is happening to you, this, that, and the other thing. Well, how can you go into somebody's house, they live there 24/7, 365 days a year, and tell them that that is a particle of dust that they've been seeing and not the spirit of, say, grandpa?
I think it's an EMF reading from an electrical outlet or a pipe running in your basement.
Exactly. I think that, you know, you should, like I said, a person should go in there and be like, well, I'm coming in here just to, at your request, and I'm not going to call you a liar or a crazy person or, you know, some kind of a drug addict who is having hallucinations, but I'm going to do what I can to find out what is really going on, and I'm just here to observe, document, and report. And I think that that's what a lot of these shows kind of miss out on.
Or they do, some of them have an agenda, for sure. That's mm-hmm. one agenda. Some of them have their own agenda that comes across strongly. It's almost sure. like they have to prove their theory at mm-hmm. the expense of the individual or the family that's suffering, for sure.
Yeah.
You know what I'd like to see? I would like to see is some kind of ongoing, and maybe it's being done, I don't know it, but some kind of ongoing investigation where somewhere, someplace that's truly haunted or somewhere there's a lot of activity where someone or a team goes back repeatedly over a long stretch of time and tries to really understand what's going on. You know what I mean? Not an hour or not just an hour, but overnight or whatever.
Oh, absolutely. Now, are there any places like, you know, with you in Canada that you would like to see be done and has a long history of being haunted?
A long history. That would probably be in Eastern Ontario, which I'm not too familiar with. I have a lot of books on it. I just can't think of them offhand. But in my own community, I live in Thunder Bay. It's just over 100,000 people. Mm-hmm. We have a few haunted areas, but I would like to see some of the ones that are being done in the States done over a longer period of time.
Sure. Yeah, you know, unfortunately, though, like most people in the Western world, we have a very short attention span. So I think that people would, you know, probably kind of lose interest in that after a while. But I think that there's definitely a lot of mysteries that need to be looked into at places like the Stanley Hotel or the Winchester Mystery House.
I'm just thinking of that one, Winchester, yeah.
Oh, okay. Or Waverly Hills Sanitarium, which is, you know, it's actually become a playground for people who are thrill seekers rather than people who are serious researchers of psychic manifestations.
I have a problem with that sometimes because, well, mental illness ran in my family, and my mother struggled with it all of her life until she died. And the psychiatric facility here, we have a large one that's being shut down, and I fear that it's going to turn into some kind of amusement park for, like you say, thrill seekers. And that's one thing that bothers me is sometimes when they go into sanitariums or psychiatric facilities and things like that, they forget, you know, the real tragedies that occurred there, and it's not fun.
Right. But before we wrap, you know, there was one particular show that I was watching, and they were talking about how this person was, it was actually here in Southern Illinois. They did the investigation. It was a former asylum, and they're talking about, you know, demons and, you know, that people were demonically possessed and that these are demonic spirits. And it's like, they don't seem to make the distinction between a human spirit or a spirit that has never been human. And I think it does an incredibly great disservice to a lot of these people who are dead, more or less, and to their family to go in there and say, you know what, you're a demon, and I'm gonna yell and scream at you for hours and hours on end until you bend to my will. Well, a real elemental or inhuman spirit is not going to bend to your will. In fact, it's going to make you bend to its will. And secondly, you have no right going in this place and telling people that were mentally ill in life and were probably mentally ill in death as well and don't understand what's going on. It does them and their family a great disservice to say that they are somehow demons. I think that has become a real problem in the paranormal community these days, and it really is something that does need to be cleaned out. But, you know, with that being said, Kim, you know, is there anything, you know, that you want to, I like to say at the end of each interview, is there anything you want to sell, you know, books, websites, you got anything coming up?
Well, I'm just trying to promote my book right now, Breaking the Beyond. It's on my website, Aneen Publishing.
Can you spell Aneen Publishing? Or rather, Aneen?
Aneen, A-H-N-E-E-N, publishing.ca.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, it definitely sounds like a very interesting book. Like I said, I have not read it, but I, you know, if I happen to see it at the library, because Rick doesn't, you know, Rick can't afford books these days. But you know, if I happen to see it at the library, I'm sure that I'll probably take it out and give it a read. And if you know our listeners are the same, you know, go to the website. You can find it at Amazon.com. Correct?
No,
you can't.
I'm never.
Okay. Well, definitely, you know, give it a read, the book Breaking the Beyond, and we've been talking to author Kim Casey for the last 40 minutes, and I think what we're going to do is we're going to take a break, we're going to pay some bills, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to Bill and Anita Murphy, and we're going to be talking to them about Thought Form Manifestation Conference that they're going to be giving. So stick around, and you know, it's been a great show so far, and hopefully the last hour will be great as well. This is Rick Hale, Paranormal Underground Radio at ztalkradio.com. Come on back.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Karen Frazier, author of Avalanche of Spirits, The Ghosts of Wellington, a new book from Ghost Night Media. In summer of 2009, I visited Wellington, Washington, a former railroad town in the Cascade Mountains of Washington State, where the worst avalanche disaster in the history of the United States occurred. 96 people lost their lives. What I found there changed my life forever. Before I visited Wellington, I wasn't sure that I believed in ghosts or even in the human soul. Now I know for sure that ghosts are real and that our souls go on after we die. You can read all about my experiences at Wellington in my new book, Avalanche of Spirits, The Ghosts of Wellington, which is on sale at Amazon.com. To learn more, visit avalancheofspirits.com. Hi everyone, it's Karen Frazier at Paranormal Underground.
And I'm Rick Hale, Paranormal Underground writer.
We're here to invite you to explore the unexplained with Paranormal Underground Radio, live and on the air.
Join us every Thursday night for paranormal talk and great guests from 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time on ztalkradio.com.
Hi, I'm Chad Wilson, publisher and co-founder of Paranormal Underground Magazine.
And I'm Cheryl Knight, editor-in-chief and co-founder of Paranormal Underground Magazine.
Every month, Paranormal Underground explores the unexplained with a free monthly online magazine.
We take an in-depth look at all kinds of unexplained phenomena, talk with some of the field's top experts, and share the latest news and information about the paranormal.
Visit us at ParanormalUnderground.net, where you can read the magazine online, explore our paranormal evidence galleries, watch videos, participate in discussions, or read blogs with some of our writers and editors.
We hope you'll join us. Visit ParanormalUnderground.net and explore the unexplained.
Do you want to keep up with what's going on at Paranormal Underground?
Then tweet us on Twitter at ParanormalUG.
Or follow us on Facebook at Paranormal Underground.
Meet us on MySpace, Paranormal Underground.
There's no need to be in the dark about what's going on at Paranormal Underground. Join us on your favorite social networking site today.
You're listening to Z-Talk Radio Network.
And welcome back to Paranormal Underground Radio at ztalkradio.com. I am your host, Rick Hale. Karen, unfortunately, she will not be joining us for the rest of the interview. For the last 40 minutes or so, we've been talking to Kim Casey, author of Breaking the Beyond, a work of fiction that sounds like it would be a fascinating read. However, right now joining us is actually a frequent flyer to the show. He's been on the show twice before. We have Bill Murphy from Sci-Fi Channel's Fact or Fake, The Paranormal Files, which is actually one of my favorite shows. Really like that one. Tonight we're going to be talking about thought form manifestation and the conference that's going to go along with it. So Bill, welcome back to the Underground.
Thank you, Rick, and thank you, Cheryl. It's good to be here.
Great. You know, it's like, you know, we were talking a little bit before about the show, but before we came back. Now, thought forms, definitely one of those things that I don't think that the psychical researchers and investigators give a whole lot of thought to, but why don't you give us a sketch of what a thought form is?
Sure, and it may not be familiar to many people that are engaged with paranormal investigating, because this really comes under the heading of, as far as the study of thought forms, of parapsychology as opposed to a paranormal investigation. Sure. So a thought form, if you, through intention and desire, if you describe an entity or try to communicate with an entity, there have been throughout history accounts of these thought forms manifesting in some ways where you can have some physical evidence of their existence. And what's even more curious about them is that they seem to take on an intelligence on their own, independent of the experimenters. So we were inspired to conduct this parapsychology-based thought form manifestation experiment as a result of the previous work of several groups, most notably a group out of Toronto, Canada, that created a personality by the name of Philip.
Philip, yeah.
And once they wrote the history of Philip, and then he began to reveal more information about himself that wasn't a part of that history that they wrote for him.
Yeah. You know, the thing that always interested me about Philip was, now, my question is this, either, okay, it was a thought form, something that they created, or is it a possibility that this was a spirit that was already in the house and was like, you know what, I'm going to have some fun with these people here? Do you think that's a possibility?
I guess anything is really possible when it comes right down to it, because we are dealing with a lot of unknowns here.
Yes.
I have always sort of leaned towards the notion that even spirit contact that a group or individuals may have are in many regards powered by the living still.
Sure.
It's, you know, memories live on by the survivors that have either lost someone or other people that continually look for a contact with spirits that have been documented by others to inhabit a specific location. So that was the other part of the inspiration for what we now call the Pearl Experiment, Pearl being the name of the imaginary woman that we created. But other, you know, some locations have well-deserved histories of being haunted. Mm-hmm. Other locations have a history that only goes far back as the written history by, maybe in some cases, the current proprietors of the location. Because,
sure,
you know, hotels that have a little bit of a spooky background to them, you know, attract additional clientele. It may discourage some people from staying there, but I think, by and large, more people want to go experience for themselves what other people report. Mm-hmm. And some of the locations, I have knowledge that they wrote their own history because they've confided me in me that that's exactly what they've done. So between those locations and between the Philip experiment, which was documented in a piece called Conjuring Philip, it's available on a DVD.
Okay.
Between both of those backgrounds, that's when we decided, you know what, let's just try it ourselves to see if there's any validity to manifesting a thought form. And
sure,
thus Pearl was born.
Now, you know, I think one of the most dramatic thought forms that I've ever read about was what Alexandra David Neal dealt with when she was in Tibet. And this was a thought form that had taken on a life of its own, and people saw him and, you know, talked with him and heard him laughing and having a good time, and, you know, started out as this really good looking guy and then just ended up in this kind of like fat demonic entity that was tearing up, you know, Mrs. David Neal's life. Now, do you think that there are certain religious traditions, like, of course, you know, Tibetan Buddhism, that will deal a little bit more with these thought forms?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and particularly Tibetan Buddhism. I mean, you kind of hit the nail on the head with that. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I know we're going to be talking a little bit later in the show about a conference that we built around the Pearl Experiment, but one of our speakers, David Weatherly, he has devoted over the past three decades into researching the history of thought forms and tulpas and specifically. And so sometimes thought forms have been created because the conjurers wish to have magical control over this thought form, and then they can execute deeds upon their request. So it's a very old practice. It goes back many, many, many thousands of years. In this modern age, instead of perhaps looking to have emotional effects on other people or, you know, causing either good or bad, mm-hmm. and in the case of what we did, I had just hoped that we would be able to record anything to suggest that Pearl had gotten a foothold at the location where we had performed the experiment.
Sure.
And we had some success, and I was greatly surprised at that because I didn't want to go in with any great expectations. It was more like, I want to do it the right way, and let's just see what happens, and what happened, you know, exceeded my expectations.
Yes, and I think that's amazingly fascinating. You know, who are the people that you're working with on this? Do you have any, you know, parapsychologists that you're working along with?
At this particular conference, or with the Pearl Experiment in particular?
With the Pearl Experiment in particular.
We used a couple of other things. I'm a psychology major, so I'm in graduate school, so I'm well versed in the study of the effects that belief has on people that hold them true in their hearts. Mm-hmm. So I understand that part, but we did something that was a little bit different from strictly a ritualistic approach, because that was also part of what we did.
Okay.
I had built a device that, to be frank, it was really more of a bit of a decoy.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to join everybody collectively, just, you know, have this conscious wholeness with all people that were attending this conference that I was an invited speaker at. And so we built this device. It had some common and not so common characteristics to it, but
mm-hmm.
I wanted everybody in the conference to hold it. I did announce that there was an experiment. We did not say what it was, but I wanted everybody through this one device, which had some heft to it, to just sort of join their forces, so to speak, and
sure.
Watched carefully what happened as it was passed around the room. A lot of people held it up to their chest because they could feel the mechanism inside of it. And so they were like, you know, what is this? And I had it screwed down tight. It wasn't going to be opened. I didn't want the components to fall out. And that was as far as I went with this one device. But what I learned after the fact, through, you know, which was kind of being dubbed as the new physics, those that acknowledge and have conducted rigorous experimentation that we can alter matter through intention and desire on a quantum level, but sometimes on a macro level where you can observe it with the naked eye as opposed to using instrumentation to measure those changes, we can observe these changes. So this device made this different from the purely ritualistic approach, but that was part of it too. We wrote all the specifics about Pearl, our imaginary friend, and she was this woman that, you know, lived in the very early 1900s, like 1905, 1910, 1915, up in that area. So we pulled characteristics from people of that time.
Mm-hmm.
And through this ritual, we tried to communicate with Pearl. So it wasn't like a seance where you were trying to communicate with a person that had once did live and verifiable through documentation. It was kind of like a reverse seance. We were trying to create this thought form through nothing more than mental energy. Mm-hmm. That being coupled with this device, I just thought, well, you know, let's just see if people can, like, record EVPs, because it was very distinct sound that we associated with Pearl. What I did not expect to happen was that a person would be able to come back to the location and actually photograph Pearl, and that's what happened.
Now, do you have anybody that you're working with, you know, that had, that you could say is a medium or, you know, anybody that's psychically gifted? And if so, do you think that a person that is psychically gifted could add energy to this thing and actually cause the thought form themselves?
Well, there was a woman that I approached who was a part of this original experiment, and she was the one that was more familiar with the process of performing a ritual.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly wasn't. I kind of came into this as trying to be an impartial observer, still hoping for the best, but sure. I was more interested in documenting the results. And so it was a group of six of us that we sat together at a dinner table, and we each wrote parts of what we thought would have been very strong character traits of Pearl.
Okay.
And the name Pearl, because she favored to wear pearls that she wore around her neck, and she would sort of swing them, and they would make this clacking sound against each other. And so that was one of the type of sounds that I thought, well, maybe if somebody can record an EVP of this sound, even though we didn't really go into, you know, drill down those specific details.
Mm-hmm.
With Pearl. I had hoped that we could have done EVPs, but it wasn't my conference. And as a result, the contact list wasn't mine to access. The person who organized the conference ended up moved away from California. And
mm-hmm.
so there weren't my ability to follow up properly.
Okay.
It was quite by chance that I met a photographer who visited the hotel where we conducted this experiment shortly after we wrapped it. Who was taking pictures in the lobby, and that's where we had our ritual, was in the
sure.
lobby itself.
Bill, when you yeah. say ritual, a lot of, you know, a word like that could actually bring some very negative connotations up to some people.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you're not sacrificing chickens to, you know, the gods or whatever. Can you, you know, walk us through this ritual, you know, step by step, and that finally resulted in this Pearl?
Oh, sure, gladly. Yeah, because I don't want people to get the wrong impression. So this wasn't Santeria or anything like that, which is another form of a ritual where you wish to control beings that are non-physical for us.
Sure.
So this wasn't anything at all like that, although I have studied people that are engaged in the practice of Santeria just from just being curious. From
mm-hmm.
just another segment of society that I'm not a part of. But
mm-hmm.
This wasn't at all like that. This was an intention-based process where we joined hands, and there was phrasing that occurred, and that was led by this one woman who actually doesn't necessarily want too much attention because she's successful in the music industry. And so this is something that she does on the side as her own study, and so she really didn't want necessarily to go public that she was involved with this, but she led it.
Okay.
She knew the particular language to use. She had some her own articles that she brought into this process. So by ritual, it was nothing more than verbalizing our intention and our desires through specific language and
okay.
in certain orders.
Okay, so definitely no sacrificing of animals involved.
Oh my gosh, no. You know, I love animals. I've been a pet owner for many, many years. I would never
yeah.
think of that. Although I
no,
happen
I
to
know.
that type of stuff. In paranormal investigating, you know, we have encountered that at cemeteries, actually. But this was nothing at all like that. This was just making it known to the location, or I don't want to sound too metaphysical, but, you know, putting it out there in the universe that this was our desire for Pearl to become part of the location and that we had hoped to communicate with her. So that was the limitations of what we did as far as our ritual. But you have to have a bit of formality when you verbalize it and you have the right phrasing and you're doing it in the right order. And we had images that we had drawn on a table, pad on a table, because we wanted very much to flesh out Pearl in every way we could. So basically we're mimicking what was done like with the Philip experiment. They drew illustrations, they wrote the history, they talked about Philip, they started communicating in a lively way. We didn't necessarily get too lively with this. I just wanted to make it very, very tidy, and that's what we did. So that explains the ritual side. Good question.
So, okay, now you've done the ritual, and you've worked this thought form named Pearl up in your mind. Have you been able to collect any kind of evidence concerning that, you know, that there's something going on and Pearl is in this thought form is causing it?
Well, it certainly appears that way, because there's the photograph that was taken by this other photographer who I did not know prior to this, and there was only the six of us knew that we had done this. Mm-hmm. This other gentleman, Jim, who's also going to be, Jim Spann, he's going to be at the conference at the same location where we created Pearl. I have no other way of phrasing it, but except to say that we created Pearl. But Jim is he's a photographer. He's really good. He actually kind of specializes in sports photography, but he likes early California architecture. And so he was shooting a series of photographs. Now, I was speaking at another conference in Colorado. Mm-hmm. Jim developed an interest in the paranormal. He caught the end of my talk on spirit photography, and I was talking about the ancient practice of photographing mirrors and mirror gazing in particular. And people
scrying.
Well, not necessarily scrying. Scrying is different, because through that haze and that unfocused imagery, you see images that are coherent to you that is not what's being reflected. In the case of mirrors, it's more, if you want to look at a fictionalized account and you've seen the movie The Skeleton Key, you'll see, like in that movie, how they cover the aspects of, like, during a wake, they would cover a mirror because it was felt that the essence of a person could be trapped in the reflection of the room. And that again is fictionalized, but the practice of gazing into a mirror to see entities that you don't see when you look directly into the room is very, very old. It's been going on for a long, long time. Now, this was kind of the unexpected part of what happened with the Pearl experiment. When Jim was doing these series of photographs, he photographed a woman that is wearing the attire that we described Pearl to be wearing. And so as I'm flipping through Jim's books at the Stanley Hotel at the conference, I happened upon this one, because the woman had this kind of an odd distortion to her in the mirror, even though the lobby being reflected was pretty clear.
Right.
And I questioned that one. I said, "What's this photo?" And he goes, "Well, it's a photo that was taken, but I really don't know how this one actually happened." And I said, "Where was this?" And because it looked familiar, and I kind of felt my heart racing a little bit.
Yeah.
And he told me it was at the Glen Tavern. And I my head just sort of jerked a little bit, and I was like, "Wow, if we can exchange contact information, I'd like to speak to you about this further." I couldn't spend too much time with Jim at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
But I did contact him. We met back at the Glen Tavern Inn. I brought an LAPD forensic photographer with me.
Okay.
Who also is going to be at the upcoming event. And we tried to recreate that photo almost like fact or fake style. You know, it's like, here we've got some evidence. Can we recreate it? And is there a simpler explanation? Because physically it doesn't make sense that a person would appear in a mirror yet not appear anywhere else in the room.
Okay.
So we explored all the geometry we possibly could. We had a live model with a woman standing in the lobby, appearing in the reflection, yet not in the lobby itself. And
wow,
we couldn't do it. We tried for almost 4 hours. I documented the whole thing. I brought one of my production cameras, a high-def camera, and I covered everything. Patrick, Garcia's photographer, was truly stumped. They ended up drawing floor plans. And doing it like what he does when he's trying to recreate crime scene photos, because criminals are dumb. They often photograph their own crimes, which is really stupid. It's often not to get caught. And then photographers come in, and by trying to shoot the same photo, they try to estimate the possible height of a suspect, so they have a place to start. Mm-hmm. And then look for other clues and anomalies that may be reflecting in the photo that could reveal the perpetrator. So Patrick pulled all of his experience and resources together to see if he could recreate this in any way possible, and couldn't do it. So this is why this conference, it almost had to happen, because I couldn't keep this information to myself anymore. It's like, well, let's bring in all the people that were associated with this, and let's talk about what happened with the Coverage Amendment. So that's why we're having this.
You know, but before we jump into the, you know, talking about the conference, of course, is this photograph published on any websites and any books, magazines? I mean, is, you know, a normal mortal like myself can go and find this picture?
I haven't, because it's not my photograph. It's actually Jim's, and so although I have the photo, you know, he emailed it to me so I could examine it. I wanted to check the metadata to be sure that there was no manipulation, that it wasn't put in Photoshop, that, you know, all the data from the camera was still embedded, and it's the real deal. I mean, you know, this is an unaltered photo that was taken by Jim, and it's not like I didn't trust Jim or I didn't trust anybody else. It just seemed to be too good to be true. Now, I've been criticized. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, when you have people like the not-so-amazing Randys of the world, you know, constantly tearing down what it is that we do, you know, it's definitely not a problem going that extra mile to authenticate such a thing.
And I would love that, but again, it's Jim's picture. He would have to make the decision if he's going to release it or not. It's part of what is now his collection of photographs that he feels have a basis in paranormal. It's the only one of Jim's collection that I have a real hands-on interest in because of its origin behind it. I started to say that some of the people that were aware of what we did weren't totally happy with it, because we created a thought forum that died in the location as a result of a crime. If you look at some of the history behind thoughtful manifestation, I believe I mentioned this, I'm not sure if we're already on the air or not, but how they thought forms historically, the ones that seem to take root, they start behaving independently of the experimenters, like Philip did. And we created a thought form that is essentially, for all time, going to be a victim. So I actually didn't think it through enough to think of, you know, those type of implications or emotions or anything like that. I think we created the information about a person. We didn't create an actual person, nor do I believe that as humans we have that ability to really create a life form. We can create the information about a life form.
Sure. Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have that kind of power. But let's talk about this about your conference. Now, you mentioned before that you said that this is something that had to happen. Where is this conference being held? And do you have independent speakers on these subjects, or is it your, or is it just yourself?
Oh no, it's not just myself. As a matter of fact, I've kind of pulled myself back a little bit because I'm presenting the data, but I brought in a whole series of speakers that most of them have some association with this in one way or another. Jim Spann, the photographer, he will certainly be there. He's not a public speaker. Mm-hmm. When I asked him to speak, it was him and his wife looked at each other, and it's like, well, I don't really do public speaking, but, he coaches Little League Baseball, and he's used to being, very verbal and very outspoken, but public speaking is different altogether. So he's got to do some preparation and some reconciliation with himself, that he's going to be staring at a room full of eyeballs, listening to every word that he's saying. So Jim is certainly going to be there. I invited, and he's going to be there, as well as John Huckard. John Huckard is the gentleman that lives in the home where the Ghost Rider Polaroids are able to create the writing. And so he's going to have a lot of those original photographs there at the conference, because that's another case that that could be the result of thought form. They feel that it's the home. After me bringing them to several programs, because I first brought them on the Biographer Channel on another show before I brought them to Sci-Fi, where we ended up featuring them on Fact or Fake. I also brought them on the news for another expose about their case. So they feel it's the home itself. I feel that it's the chemistry of the occupants, maybe in conjunction with the home, but they certainly, they're key to it. The odd thing about the Ghost Rider case is that they don't provide the cameras or the film. You bring your own.
That's what I thought was really great about authenticating that case is when you guys did it on the show, if I remember correctly, you opened up, an unopened Polaroid film. And I'd also seen it on the Biography Channel as well, that where people were doing that. Is there any way that you can manipulate Polaroid film that it shows that kind of thing before you take it out of the package?
That's what we did for a Fact or Fake. I was the story producer for the Biography Channel, and actually I only brought real authentic cases that I did all the verification I possibly could. So I brought them in there and I got their word on it. But for Fact or Fake, what we do on that show. It's all about replication to try to see if there is a simple explanation before you leap towards it being paranormal and therefore anomalous and not necessarily repeatable. So we did manipulate the film. As a matter of fact, in the opening sequence, the title of Fact or Fake, it's still those seconds that they show with my name where I'm actually drawing on the plexiglass that we brought into the home. And so I don't know if that's going to be on season 3, it's remained that way, but it's been that way for everything else. But we did create stencils, so to speak, and then in a dark room, exposed Polaroid film to a burst of light, and where the stencil had its openings, there were the phrases, the words, and then you reload it back in the cartridge, and then when you take a second photo, it's additionally exposed to light again a second time. And so the idea is that where you've got two exposures, it'd be overexposed, and you'd have words that appear in white, and they look like they're floating. Well, the problem with that is that when you expose a Polaroid like that, it ends up shifting the tonality of the entire image. So we thought we had it right. We had a light tight room. We tried it. It still was doing that tonal shift, but we weren't applying an electrical charge to the film cartridge, and that's how Polaroids work. It's got a battery in the cartridge, and when you do that charge, the emulsion, which is in packets, is then spread over the whole image, and then it develops. And so when we thought we had it done and we went into the house, it didn't happen anywhere else except in the house. When we did that pre-exposed, now took a photo in the house, let's see if we can make it look like a ghost Polaroid, that strange ectoplasmic mass occurred on our Polaroids, obscuring the messages that we had done in the lab. And I was flabbergasted. I was like, okay, now this is everything that they said it was. And you take photos in this one small area of the house, and this shows up on film. So it was defeating all of our efforts to try to sort of explain away the phenomenon as being something...
I was just going to say, which definitely shows that whatever this is has some kind of intelligence and intent.
Yeah, and, you know, as a little side note to that, as we're in the midst of filming season 3 of Factor Fate, you know, in the Situation Room, there was a desk in a corner, and I was just kind of walking around yesterday, actually, in our Situation Room, and I saw that they had brought those original Polaroids from that case, and they had them laying across a table that is behind the big monitor that we all look at the videos on. And I was kind of like, oh my gosh, I mean, these are priceless. They just they so casually tossed them on a desk in the back of the room. I was a bit horrified, to be honest with you. But
that would be like me taking the first issue of Spider-Man and just tossing it around the room.
Yeah, kind of. I was like, I looked around, I was like, oh, guys, these are like our original, you know, Ghost Rider photos when we went back into the house to replicate it. But it seemed like it was, people weren't as shooken up by it as I was. But whatever, I'm connected to that case in a way that goes back many years because I've been researching it for so long.
Sure. Yeah. And it's definitely been shown on many different things. I think it was shown on Sightings, which was a show that I loved. I thought that was one of the first, that was one of the original and one of the greatest shows. But now I have a question for you about recreating things. Now, a lot of people seem to believe that, well, if you recreate it, then that means that explains it. But I can recreate the paintings on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, but that doesn't explain the genius of the artist. Do you think that it's sort of egotistical saying, well, just because I can replicate this, I've explained it? Or is it just that, well, I replicated something that was done by an as of yet unknown intelligence? What do you think about that?
Well, you bring up a really good point, and we've addressed that since the very cycle. I know for the viewer, you know, they watch the show in terms of seasons. For those that are involved in the production of the show, it's always in cycles. So the very first cycle of 6 episodes, I had brought that up, and so did Ben, that just because we can replicate it, we can't make this proclamation that we now can undo the belief of those that have had the experience in many cases for years on end, that it's presumptuous of us to do so. And so we don't make those kind of statements with a period at the end of it saying, well, there you go, we've proved it. You know, we proved that maybe it can be replicated, but it does not undo eyewitness accounts by any means. So you'll never see us saying, you know, definitively, unless we really are, if we're convinced, and we will make a statement that we're reasonably sure that we know exactly what it is. And not only that, in cases where we say we know this is how it was done, we feel 100% confident, it's because we've already confirmed it during the course of our investigation. You know, we're always pursuing and trying to find out the truth behind it. And unfortunately, you have to go to those locations. People say, well, why didn't they just make a phone call? Well, our phone call is different from a face-to-face meeting. And once we get there and we start following the trail, we have found out in many cases, oh, okay, this was skydivers, for example. Because we'll meet the skydivers who did it, and we look at their gear, and they tell us exactly what they did. Sometimes they don't want to go public because they're part of a larger group. So we'll only say we're absolutely certain when we are certain.
Right. Well, one of the cases that I found most interesting on your show is, and it's like even the untrained eye could tell that the video is an obvious fake. The alien walking behind the reporter, I think that was in Chile, right?
Argentina.
Thank you very much. I know it's South America. It was such an obvious fake. I mean, if you believed that video, then, you know, maybe you need to open up your eyes a little bit. But you guys did get confirmation that this was a fake by the faker. Now, what do you think prompts a person to make an obvious hoax?
Well, in the case of that episode specifically, there's a couple of things I'd like to bring to your audience's attention. One, the version that we had was a web version, which did not have the resolution of the tape that we ended up getting and that ended up airing. And so it wasn't so clear on the outset. And mm-hmm. once we got the footage from the editor who actually did it, and we aired that, then people were like, well, gosh, I mean, you could see it so clearly. But we only had a grainy, pixelized version with many compression artifacts that obscured, many of the details. And so it took going there. Now, to answer your question directly, the reason why he did it is because of all the eyewitness accounts of what people claim to be aliens or some sort of beings that aren't human in that area. So it was done to acknowledge what people have been reporting in that town for the past two decades. And they have this annual conference. And so that editor did it for that news station prior to the conference. It's just kind of like, you know, generate interest. And it was meant to be goodwill. He didn't know that it would create the kind of stir that it did. And so a lot of these things came out once we were there and did the interview.
But didn't anybody consider that admitting to this being hoax or an obvious, you know, I don't even know if I want to even call it a hoax, because it sort of was something that got out of, you know, control from the original editor. But don't you think that they would have thought, wow, this is going to have the actual opposite effect? I mean, now admitting that this is a fake, then everything else that goes on there is just, well, is up for discussion. Didn't they think that?
Well, I mean, you would have thought he would have, but I mean, the same thing just happened this week. I mean, the Siberian woolly mammoth video.
I that loved that viral, video. Yeah.
Yeah, that was an accident. I mean, the guy did it because he was researching his grandfather's footsteps when he walked across Siberia after escaping from a concentration camp. Mm-hmm. And so he did it. He videotaped that little stream, river, whatever that body of water really was, and mm-hmm. he, you know, added the mammoth in CG and posted it, and look what happened there. Now he went public right away and go, oops, sorry folks, I didn't mean this to happen. I'm an author and I did this kind of for fun. So people do create little videos and post them for fun, and paranormal themed videos are something that people they like to do, and it does make it more difficult for the serious paranormal investigator.
Yeah. Yeah, I posted that on my Facebook page, and even people in my family, family and friends who are, they know what I do and they respect it, but they really have no interest. Even they were like, you know, this is such an obvious fake. You can watch this thing as it's moving along. It's not making any ripples in the water. And I had actually heard, though, that this was a bear that was carrying a fish in its mouth, but they were able to turn that fish somehow into a trunk. Now, do you know if that's it?
No, there was nothing, because he posted the original video, and there was no animal at all.
Okay.
It's completely fabricated, the woolly mammoth itself. And so I think it was also, it was innocent of him to do it.
Oh, sure.
And but for those that research cryptids and hold out belief that we will, you know, solve some of these ancient riddles like a Bigfoot and Nessie and all these other creatures that you really can't seem to locate, it sort of burst their bubble. But yeah. Those people should take comfort in knowing that every single year, it's over 20,000 new species of life that are discovered, mainly in the insect kingdom. But still, there's a whole lot out there in this world that has yet to be found. So the Quixote Cloud, hang in there. There's more to come, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely... I still believe that we live in a very large world. I mean, although we have iPhones and iPads and computers and all this, there has to be some... People are seeing something, you know, with like Bigfoot or the Jersey Devil or, you know, what have you. People are seeing something that may have a basis in reality. Not everybody is a crazy person, a liar, or a drug addict. They're definitely seeing something. But let me ask you this. You know, when you talk about, you know, obvious hoaxes and, you know, even doing it with goodwill involved, I know that you've been doing this, like myself, before it was considered cool. Do you think that this kind of thing just as a whole would hurt serious psychological, or rather, paranormal investigators and researchers rather than helping us? Do you think that there is way too many people involved with this right now, and then, you know, fortunately, it's going to collapse in on itself?
When you say involved with it, are you talking about research or the creation of these videos?
No, I'm talking about investigating. You know, you get like these videos and these pictures that people, you know, recreate, or they do it as obvious hoaxes, and then they claim to be, you know, paranormal researchers and investigators, and they're really out for it just to be, you know, famous. Do you think that that hurts the rest of us who actually take a very serious view on this?
Yeah, I do. I would hope that the, you know, intelligent enthusiast will be able to differentiate between those that do it for what they consider to be entertainment value and those that are really trying to, you know, advance the study, that they can see the difference between the two. Mm-hmm. I'm probably more concerned with those that may have other issues going on in their lives, and they attribute it to causes that are elusive because they feel that they're paranormal in nature, when in fact they may have issues that are very predictable. So that's kind of a larger concern, because, you know, if you do believe in something, I mean, it will be true, and mm-hmm. it's, there's no phrase. What you fear will kill you. And it's the opposite is true as well. If you do believe that you can recover, then you will. So the mind does have a physical effect, not only on its own body, but at the world at large. And that's, if you don't mind, I'm going to kind of steer back on what we're going to be doing at the conference in March.
Oh, yeah, please.
Because I wanted to really expand upon that, because with the image that we got, which appears to match the description of Pearl, but I have to use language that it's subjective in nature, or opinion of what we're looking at, and I've got to choose my words carefully. So to kind of move it forward, I wanted to do another experiment that wouldn't be so opinion-based, one that would be very, very precise. And so I'm using a random event generator from Princeton's Pear Lab, and we're going to very precisely measure the effect of atomic particles through our own intention, through the group's intention. Okay. You know, can we create order from randomness, because that's what actually is occurring. Now, if you want to see an example of creating order of randomness, just pick up any glass or look at the sand on the beach. The sand on the beach and the, you know, crystalline structure is its natural state. You sure. fire it, you melt it, the bonding of those crystals then becomes fluid, and then you can rebond them into a shape that you want, and you have a drinking glass that works. But mm-hmm. gravity is always at work, and eventually gravity will most likely claim that glass, and it'll become shards, and they'll get ground down, and then the Earth will reclaim them in the form that they once were. And those are just, you know, in the crystalline structure as grains. And so that's creating order from a natural chaotic state. And that's sure. how these random event generators work. They take the randomness of it's quantum tunneling is what it is. You fire an electron at a barrier, and when it hits the barrier, something odd happens when you measure it, and that's the particle exhibits properties of a wave. Once it becomes a wave on the other side of the barrier, you can amplify that signal, and you can then statistically analyze it. And you go, okay, this is very random. Mm-hmm. It's like 50-50. It's very reliable that it's going to have a random output of these generators. But when humans think about it, then they're imposing order on it, on physical material. Now you can track that, and you can track those results in real time. So I'm taking the idea of the Pearl experiment, I'm throwing science at it, and everybody can be a part of it, and they can see that science can actually be a lot of fun, because it's drudgery to look at a graph, right? I mean, it's like, okay, yeah, I can look at a paint dry too. But yeah, when you're actively affecting the output of this generator, and you can see the results in real time, it becomes fun again. And so that's going to be the new experiment that we're going to be conducting at the event in March.
Great. Yeah, so, Bill, I think what we're going to do is we are going to wrap now, because we are coming up to the top of the hour. We got to, talk a little bit about what we got coming up for the show. Can you give us a date and where the conference is being held? And anything else that you want to tell us about that you got coming up?
Do you have any call-in listeners?
No, we really don't. I don't think we have that capability. Cheryl, do we?
Oh, we do have that capability, but we can only pretty much take one caller at a time, and they have to hold. It's a Skype thing.
Okay. Well, we won't bother with that right now. There was something else I was going to offer out there for your viewers, but we can do this at another time. But anyway, to answer your question, Rick, the event is going to be held March 23rd to the 25th in Santa Paula, California. There's a whole group of people that's going to be there. And, in addition to Jim Spann and John Hunter from Ghost Rider, Keith Engel, the developer of the full-spectrum cameras that we used on almost all the sci-fi shows, is going to be there. Paul Bradford from Ghost Hunters International, David Weatherly, the gentleman who's been researching thought forms for the past 30 years. Los Angeles Paranormal Association is going to be there. Live Sci-Fi, Tim Wood and Patrick Landlin is going to be there. My wife, Anita, and myself will, of course, will be there. If anybody's interested in learning more about what we're going to be doing and you want to attend, please go to the following website. It's ghosttown.tv. So I'll spell it, www.ghosttown.tv. And tickets are available right now.
Outstanding. I mean, it sounds like a great event, and if you can definitely make it. Unfortunately, me being here in Chicago, I can't really get out to California at the time. But you know what, Bill? Thanks for coming on the show. It's always great having you as a guest, because you're a fascinating guy, and you're a gentleman. So thank you for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me on, Rick. And Cheryl, thank you, too. You guys have a great night.
Thanks.
You too.
Thanks, you too.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, okay. All right. Yeah, always talking. It's always a pleasure talking to Bill. I mean, he's definitely one of those people that that I like to say get it.
Yeah. intriguing conversation.
What's that?
It was intriguing conversation. I actually wish I could attend the Thought Form Manifestation get together.
I got the sense that there was so much more that he wanted to talk about, but unfortunately, I have to go to my real job as soon as I'm off the air here. But, next week, the 23rd, we don't have a show, and
so
I'm going to be taking a bye week on that. And but the following week, we're going to be coming back, and we're going to be talking to Nigel Kerner. Now, Nigel Kerner, obviously, he's from Great Britain with a name like Nigel, but we're going to be talking to Nigel Kerner, and he's the author of Grey Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls. It's a fascinating read. I've read a little bit of it on the internet. Apparently, we're supposed to be having the books coming soon. But we're going to be talking about his theories concerning aliens and what it is that they're really all about. Would you say that's true, Cheryl?
Yeah, he's got a really interesting perspective, theory, whatever you want to call it, on what the Greys are really doing here. In fact, if people want to read about a little bit about his theory, also in addition to going to his website, but in the last issue of the magazine, he wrote a guest editorial for us called Cyber Hugs and Robot Babies, A Brave New World. And people can read that for free on paranormalunderground.net. It's in our most recent magazine. I think it's December 2011. But it gives you a little peek into his thoughts. And boy, they are interesting.
Yeah, you know what? I like Karen said, I hope that this is a show that's not going to give me nightmares and make me think that there's an anal probe with my name out there somewhere. But so anyways, that's going to be March 1st. And, you know, like I said, next week we have a bye week. You know, is there anything else that, you know, we have coming up, Cheryl?
Yeah, we have, after Nigel joins us on March 1st, we are going to have a guest named Bill Sweet from spindriftresearch.org, if people want to check out his site, on March 8th, and we'll be talking to him about exploring consciousness and prayer with scientific method. And I don't believe we've talked about that before on this show, so it should be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have heard in the past that prayer does, of course, have a positive effect, and I kind of think of that, that's like, is that the force of a person's will, or is that really a divine creator working behind the scenes there? But I guess we're going to find out with him.
Yeah, that's a very good question, and I think we'll get to talk about that very thing.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So, you know, hey, it was a great show, you know, talking to Kim Casey to start with, and then, you know, Bill, he's always fascinating. Unfortunately, the Mrs. Anita couldn't be here, but, you know, maybe the next time we'll have him on.
Yeah.
And we'll get a peek into Bill and Anita Murphy and how they live their lives. So, you know, with that being said, I think we're going to sign off right now. This is Paranormal Underground Radio at ztalkradio.com. I was your host, Rick Hale, and I will see you in 2 weeks. And hopefully Karen will get her computer problems worked out, and she'll be able to join us next time. So thanks a lot for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Bye.
If you'd like to be a guest on Paranormal Underground Radio, email editor@paranormalunderground.net. Until next week, keep exploring the unexplained at www.paranormalunderground.net, and join us again next week for Paranormal Underground Radio on the Z Talk Radio Network.